Okay, so we are recording and good to go. Welcome everyone, it's great to start a new year of learning and go into a series of the bad guys of the Bible. Where, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've found myself increasingly interested with the kind of underbelly of Jewish thinking, some of the darker ideas within the Torah. This was some of the thinking behind the drashot that I did over the High Holidays, which were primarily about sin. And the bad guys of the Bible on the other is similar to that, in that we're looking at some of our more nefarious characters. And I don't know why I've been drawn there. Maybe it's just the state of the world. But also, I was thinking about a statement in a piece in the Halacha where there's a preference that the leader of services on the High Holidays should be 30 or older. I did this in a daily minyan, and one of the reasons given by the Mishnah Berurah by Rabbi Israel Meir Kagan is because someone who's 30 or older feels the kind of the pain of the world around them. So I don't know, maybe I'm just at this new existential state where the world seems a little bit more realistic or darker than it once did.
It took away till they get to be 60.
God willing, I'll make it there. How's it from?
Welcome to parenthood.
Thank you. I don't know what it is, but I also think, and this is part of where my own religious life has been going, that in acknowledging the darkness of life, it also affords us an opportunity to understand goodness and light in more clarity. It's kind of like the image of you don't appreciate a candle burning in the middle of the day, but when you light a candle in the middle of a dark room, you suddenly feel its effects much more powerfully. And I think that's true about some of these topics that we're going to be learning here. So that brought me to this topic of the bad guys of the Bible, some of the darker figures, some of the sinners whose stories we learn. I'll just give an introduction, and I think for me this has formulated a lot of my thinking. It's a story from Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz is a very famous, well-known rabbi. He translated the entire Talmud into Hebrew, and his students translated his Hebrew translation into English. If anyone's seen the Koran edition of the Talmud, that's all based on the teachings of Rabbi Steinsaltz. And there's a story that is written in a book about Rabbi Steinsaltz where a young woman comes up to him. She's in her gap year attending seminary in Israel after high school. And she realizes that one of her heroes in high school, whose name was Bruria, Bruria is a female scholar in the Talmud who's married to Rabbi Meir, and she finds out about what the Talmud refers to as Maase de Bruria, the occasion or the event of Bruria, where essentially, according to at least Rashi, Rabbi Meir has a student seduce his wife to see if she'll betray him, and she does end up being unfaithful with Rabbi Meir's student, who he sent upon her, and then according to Rashi, she commits suicide, and Rabbi Meir is so humiliated and so embarrassed and kind of descended into this really bad place that he flees from Israel to Babylon. And that's how the Talmud explains Rabbi Meir going to Babylon from Israel. And in the story, at least with Rabbi Steinsaltz, a young woman comes to him and says, like, this was my hero, and like, how can I understand my hero having done such a thing? And Rabbi Steinsaltz's line is, and there's lots of ways to interpret this, but it's always stuck with me, is we don't have plastic saints in Judaism. That Judaism is made up of real life people who are capable of great good and also great evil. And our avot and imahot, our forefathers and foremothers, certainly fall into that category, where people like Nachmanides Ramban criticizes Avram and Sarah for how they treated Hagar. And how they treated Ishmael, and basically suggests that if it weren't for this kind of petty competition, then maybe, you know, our 4,000 years of Jewish history may have turned a different way. And I think it's okay to be comfortable with people's mistakes and people's failures and people's sins, and to learn lessons from them as opposed to shunning them aside. And for me, that's actually one of the most beautiful parts of the Jewish canon, is that we have stories of real-life people who made bad mistakes. And with that, let's study about the world's first murderer, none other than Cain. So I'll use the term, I'm going to use the Hebrew names today instead of Cain and Abel. I'm going to just go back and forth between Cain and Hevel. And I think the language is really important And what I'd like to do is actually just a careful reading of the story itself to understand some of the details behind it, because we've all heard the story of Cain and Abel, but there are so many layers beneath the simple reading of the story, so many questions that emerge from the text itself. And if we're able to kind of dig in on some of those questions, on some of those minute points, we'll see that there are layers upon layers upon layers built into this story. And that's what I'd like to explore tonight together. And in doing so, I think we can learn lessons for our lives, hopefully without us having to repeat the same mistakes of Cain, the first murderer of the world as well. So just as an aside to kind of show you what does the Talmud think is the main lesson of the story of Cain and Abel, if I asked you that question, just what is the main message, the main takeaway from the story of Cain and Abel? What would you suggest? You don't have to think too hard about it. Yeah. You are your brother's keeper. Okay. Anyone else?
Bring your best offerings.
Bring your best. I think that's... what does Rabbi Leonard Cohen say? Forget your perfect offering. Mm. There's a crack. Okay, another time. A crack in everything. Yeah. But maybe that's the lesson and the takeaway here. We'll get to that. There are many commentaries who suggest that. Anything else?
Jealousy
is bad. Jealousy has bad consequences. Where do we see that? Okay, you know, let's
everywhere.
Hold on to that everywhere. Okay. Anything else?
Related to that is sibling rivalry.
Okay, sibling rivalry. You know what I think the most obvious basic idea that comes out of the story is, and we take it for granted. So I don't think anyone mentioned it for that reason. Yeah, thou shalt not murder. And that's
well,
when
there
the...
wasn't.
What?
Who knew?
Now we know, because
well,
of Cain.
Sure, yeah,
because of Cain.
You know a computer, but you didn't know that 500 years ago. Now you know murder.
I hear. So we'll actually see that this is, at least according to one source in the Mishnah, and I thought this was an interesting way to enter into the story. According to one source in the Mishnah, this is the primary lesson of the story of Cain and Abel. Is how serious the effects of murder are, how serious the effect of murder is upon the world. So would anyone like to read, this is, I quoted it from the Talmud, but this is actually a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. Oh, thanks, Kirsten. I'll just give one more note of background here. This chapter in Sanhedrin is interested in the jurisprudence process, how court systems work in the Sanhedrin, in the high court. And this high court existed until shortly after the destruction of the Second Temple, probably around the year 100. And one of the important things in a high court sitting, and then Kirsten, you're good to go, is that you're supposed to literally scare the living daylights out of witnesses under certain circumstances to make absolutely sure that they are not lying in their testimony. And that's what this mission is going to talk about. It's called Iyum. You literally put the fear of God into them. Before they give testimony. So let's use that as our context here. Yeah, Kirsten, go ahead.
How did they admonish witnesses in capital cases? They brought them in and admonished them, saying, perhaps you will say something that is only a supposition or hearsay, a second hand, or even from a trustworthy man. Or perhaps you do not know that we shall check you with examination and inquiry. Know, moreover, that capital cases are not like non-capital cases. In non-capital cases, a man may pay money and so make atonement. But in capital cases, the witness is answerable for the blood of him that is wrongfully condemned and the blood of his descendants that should have been born to him to the end of the world. For so we have found it with Cain that murdered his brother. For it says, the bloods of your brother cry out. It doesn't say the blood of your brother, but rather the bloods of your brother, meaning his blood and the blood of his descendants.
And this is actually one of the origins for the Mishnaic idea that if one who saves a life is as if they saved an entire world, it actually emerges from this verse here that Kirsten just read in English. I'll read it in Hebrew. Demei achecha tzuakim. This is God calling out to Cain. The Dme, which is that's a juxtaposition of damim shel achecha, the bloods, plural, of your brother. And the Talmud here is implying the question, normally you refer to a person's blood in the singular, so what's the plural of blood? And the answer is, when you, Cain, killed Hevel, you were not just killing Hevel, you were in fact killing Hevel and Hevel's potential descendants and their potential descendants and their potential descendants, which is one of the origins for the Mishnaic idea that one who saves one Jewish life is as if they saved the world, and one who takes a life is as if they took an entire world. Because murder is not just about one person. Murder is about the entire world that exists within that person in capability and potential. So kind of heavy material there. The story of Cain and Hevel, I think this Mishnah's takeaway is murder is really a big deal, right? And the consequences of murder go far beyond the specifics of that one case or that one interaction, right? The effects of that, it's like casting a rock into a pond, that it has ripple effects beyond what you could possibly imagine. That's like the Mishnaic idea of what do we learn from this story. I'll tell you that, you know, some of the takeaways that I had, and I wrote some notes here that if you'd like, you can hold on to them for later. In terms of this being a multi-layered story, one is the evil of murder. Another idea that I think comes out, and we'll go back and read the text itself, right? Sibling rivalry is one of the major themes of the entire book of Bereishit, the entire book of Genesis. It starts with Cain and Hevel, and it continues. We would assume with maybe Abraham and his siblings, we don't really know this, certainly continues with Noah's children. There's already competition there. And then with Yitzchak and Ishmael and Yaakov and Esav and the brothers, Yaakov's children, right? It seems that the first time that you end up having any reconciliation between siblings is really the brothers, the children of Yaakov, right? When Yosef ends up making amends with his brothers. You could really read the entire book of Bereishit as a book about the difficulty of family relationships, particularly through the frame of sibling rivalries. Cain and Hevel, even though it's the first murder, it's the first of many attempted sibling murders in the book of Genesis. If you think about, right, there's at least midrashic ideas of Yishmael trying to kill Yitzchak, certainly Esav trying to kill Yaakov, the brothers trying to kill Yosef in the pit. Right? This is some modern biblical scholars talk about echoes in the Bible and how biblical stories echo themselves. And you'll find references or kind of hints to them later on. This is one of the paradigm stories that continues to echo itself throughout the rest of Chumash. And so it takes on that meaning. I think this is also, I don't know if we got to this before, this is a story about how hard it is for people to relate to God. Right? Because it is a story about bringing offerings. And it's a story that's really about how difficult it is for human beings living on earth to reach up to a transcendent being up in heaven. If you think about it in that frame, in that kind of light, it really is a continuation of the Garden of Eden story, and we'll get back to this by the end of the class, that there's this closeness of God in Adam and Eve in potential, and then there's the sin and there's the banishment from the garden. The Garden of Eden represents this euphoric place where we could live with God, where the Spirit of God is kind of contained within the garden, and all of a sudden we're banished. And the proving the cherubs are placed with fiery swords to keep us from that place where we once lived with God. And just as the Garden of Eden might make a return, I taught this over Shavuot, maybe in the temple you see the echoes of the Garden of Eden, maybe in the land of Israel you see the echoes of the Garden of Eden, but we don't know how to get back there. And you could understand the story of Cain and Hevel as two sons whose parents sinned trying to make their way back to a God who had banished their parents. Because it's a story about sacrifice and trying to bring yourself close to God. And I think finally, this is, who said, we are our brother's, I am my brother's keeper. I think it's also a story of how hard it is for human beings to take responsibility for their actions, which also is very much an echo of the sins of the fathers, right? And the father and the mother here in this case, right? That Cain does not take responsibility, with very similar language to how Adam and Chava did not take responsibility, right? In the Garden of Eden, right? When God asks them, "Where are you?" Right? Their response is, "Oh, you know, we're just busy hiding because we were naked." And now, when God approaches Cain, the son, right, the living son, "Where are you?" Because it's not where are you, it's where is your brother, Eyachecha, where is your brother? Similar to when God asks Adam and Eve, Ayeka, where are you? Now it's Eyachecha, but still similar language of Aleph Yud. And now it's, why should I know where my brother is? But you have echoes of the earlier story repeating themselves here. And it's a challenge, and I think Bereishit is really a challenge of how do individuals reach God? You can see these echoes kind of repeat themselves too. Lee, were you going to add something?
It also shows that the minute one does something wrong, you realize right away, oh, this is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And then try to hide and not take responsibility for it.
Yeah.
It's always someone else's fault.
Yeah. There definitely is the theme of hiding. What I'd like to suggest tonight is that there are many of the details in the story are deeply meaningful in terms of understanding the lessons of the story. So some of them just kind of to let you know where we're going. The meaning behind your names is deeply meaningful. Their chosen professions for most of the commentaries is deeply meaningful. The literary analysis of, you know, how is the story unfolding is meaningful, and we'll try to break that down a little bit in terms of who plays what role and how does the dialogue move back and forth. And if you can imagine yourself in like a theater setting, who's the spotlight at on any given moment, you'll see kind of that interplay as well. And lots more to go. But for now, I would just like us to read together this story. It's the second source on the first page. Let's read it together. What I've done here is taken bold words and put in little footnotes, basically, that are going to lead us to questions that I want to ask about all those bolded words. And I have thoughts about all of them. These are based on many of the commentators, the classic commentators and some modern commentaries as well. But for now, I'd like to just ask everyone to read 2 verses per person, and so we can go around. We went counterclockwise before. We'll go counterclockwise this time. Terry, do you want to start us off with verses 1 and 2?
Now the man knew his wife Eve, and she conceived and bore Cain, saying, "I have gained a male child with the help of the Lord."
I'll just pause you there. Sorry. What now implies a certain period of time? So what is this period of time? I'll let you know from the get-go that there's a debate in the commentaries of when this actually happened, when verse 1 takes place. The simple reading, if you're just following the chronology of verses, is that this is right after the exile from the Garden of Eden. But there are commentaries who suggest, and we'll get there at the end, that the Hebrew here is v'ha'adam yada, and man, which is where the English "and now" comes from. But it's "and man yada knew," which is past tense, "Chava," his wife, which implies maybe that verse 1 takes place at some point earlier than the rest of this chapter. And what might that point be? This point might have been in the Garden of Eden before the sin. So we actually have a debate or an uncertainty of when was the first person, Cain, born. Was he born after exile or was he born before exile? And that might actually have something to do with this story. I'll get back with a theory that suggests that the simple reading is this is after, because that's the whole context of the chapter. But there's one thinker, a contemporary thinker, who places verse 1 back in the Garden of Eden. And we'll develop that a little bit more later. But keep going, Terry.
She then bore his brother Abel. Abel became a keeper of sheep, and Cain became a tiller of the soil.
Okay. I'll pause here to just ask, do we know any words similar to the Hebrew Cain, which is kofyud nun? Because the Torah is giving us, and this is much easier in the Hebrew than the English. If you look at the bolded word on the second line, right, the Torah is giving us a word that is very related to Cain. It's telling us that this is where Cain's name comes from. So here, Chava gives birth.
Nun, yud.
Taf, yud. Yeah. So it's possible that Kain is related to the roots Kuf Nun He, Kana, which means to acquire or to buy. And I don't think this is actually a great translation, at least according to the theories that we're going to suggest tonight. So you have the words, I have gained. But here there seems to be some connection of, I have acquired a man, et Hashem. Somehow, like, I've acquired a man with God. So hold that thought for now. But Kain here is connected to the word, I've acquired or bought for myself. Okay. On the other hand, Hevel. Abel takes actually so much of the juiciness of this story out when you disconnect it from its Hebrew root. Hevel, does that sound like a familiar word? Okay. Well, yeah.
Breath.
Breath. Vanity. Right. Something fleeting. Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, which we read on the Shabbat of Sukkot. You have this, Kohelet is one of the later books in the Bible, this wealthy king, we don't really know much about him, the Midrashic understanding is it's King Solomon as an older man, who says, I have accomplished all this stuff, I'm a king, and at the end of the day, what do I have to say for myself? Havel, havelim, amar Kohelet, havel, havelim, hakol havel, right? Vanity of vanities, says Kohelet, vanity of vanities, everything is in vain, which the word there, it's often translated as vanity, like purposeless, futility. Everything is without a point, without a meaning. But hevel can also mean, and we'll see this in other contexts, breath. And there's something connected between those meanings because breath is something that you can't hold on to. Right? Breath, is, once you exhale, there's no way to really capture that. I guess now that we can, we know a little bit more about science, we could put a, in theory, you could put a bag in front of your mouth and try to capture the carbon dioxide that you're exhaling. But the idea that the way Tanakh thinks about Hevel is both something that's vain, that's meaninglessness, and also that's like a fleeting breath. And we'll get back to the competing meanings of what that might have to do with the story. Pauline, would you like to continue from verse 3 and 4?
Yes. In the course of time, Cain brought an offering to the Lord from the fruit of the soil. And Abel, for his part, brought the choicest of the firstlings of his flock. The Lord paid heed to Abel and his offering.
Okay. So verses 1 and 2 kind of serve as their own mini-unit. It's kind of the introduction to the story, right? It's, here are the characters that we're going to be discussing, and these are their names, and this is how they came to be, and this is what they do, right? Verses 3 is where the action starts. Right? It's where the actual plot begins. Because we have Cain bringing offering to God. What Cain brings an offering, Hevel brings an offering, and God accepts Hevel's offering. So far, all we know is that Cain brings the first offering. And it's hard to imagine this today, but this is the first offering in the history of the universe. Right? That's a big deal. And when you start to think about what are Cain's motives in getting upset and angry and killing his brother, right? One thing that's easy to forget is he was really the first. That's a big innovation, that there's such an idea that one can bring something to God.
How did he know to do that?
Right. How did he know to do that? What gave him that idea?
He was a tool of the earth.
Right. And so what does he bring? That's actually, if you look at the Hebrew side of this verse, verse 3, right, pri ha'adama. Does that sound familiar? Mm-hmm. That's the end of one of, right, our bracha, our blessing when you eat vegetables, yes, is blessed are you, God, King of the universe, right, borei pri ha'adama, who creates the fruit of the earth. That's in contrast to another blessing that we make on vegetation, which is, right, for fruits of the tree. And that begs the question of which one is better. Right? Which category of vegetation is considered higher? And we actually have halachic literature about this. Right? That generally speaking, we have a preference that when you make blessings, if you have a bunch of things on your plate and you have to choose which blessing to make first, you normally start with the highest order blessing, the thing that's considered the most honored, and then you go down in order. And the preference in terms of the order of blessings is you start with borei pri ha'etz, you start with fruits of the tree, and then you go to borei pri adama, fruits of the earth. Trees, at least in the halachic mindset, are actually considered more honored and dignified. So maybe there's some significance here. We know that Cain's a farmer. We're not going to put him down for being a farmer necessarily. But what kind of farming did he choose to bring to God? Maybe he could have chosen a better offering. Maybe that's something coming from this. And we'll get back to that soon.
Or
yeah.
The motivation.
Okay.
What was his motivation in bringing an offering as opposed to Hevel's motivation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that may have been the big difference.
Do we see in verses 3 and 4 any hints to motivations?
Well, Hevel brought the choicest.
Okay, so what might that suggest about Hevel's?
He was choosing to bring the best because he thought that was he had such a reverence for Hashem, mm-hmm. that he wanted to bring the best.
Right.
You know, I know that some commentators think that Cain saw this as a quid pro quo. I will bring something to you, so you will give something to me.
Uh-huh.
Whereas maybe Hevel was not looking for something in return.
Okay. So there's something about the motivations for the offerings. Kirsten, you were going to say something.
So if he knew by eating the fruit of the tree, his parents were banished from the Garden of Eden, it would make sense that he wouldn't bring an offering from a tree to Hashem.
So maybe this is second generation trauma. Right.
That he would bring something different.
Uh-huh.
Because fruit of trees, that can lead to places
it's a bad place.
Might not want to be.
Even though God told Adam and Chava, you can eat every tree in the garden except for that one, right? There might be, you know, there's an interesting expression, asu siag la Torah, make a fence around the biblical law, right? So God said just don't eat one tree. And you just ate too many. I think there's a commentary that says that part of the way the snake tricked Chava was by convincing her that there was more trees forbidden other than the tree of knowledge itself. And so God, like this Satan, the evil inclination, first convinced her to think that another tree was forbidden and then had her touch that tree. And when she didn't die, Satan said, or the snake said, see, that wasn't so bad. Now you can touch this one too. That's fascinating. It's interesting, there's a rabbinic thinking that there's a rabbinic expression that just as it is forbidden to say on something that, just as it is bad to say that a forbidden thing is permitted, so too is it is bad to say that a permitted thing is forbidden. And so maybe that's actually what's happening, that Cain is like anxious, trees got my parents in trouble, I don't want to go there. And maybe there's also something problematic about it. I'm just suggesting. To your thought, but I find that fascinating.
The first offering, how would you know which one's good?
Okay.
Because
right. So if we were to make like a scoreboard here, right, we could level up a few things against each other, right? On the one hand, Cain's got a big plus for bringing the first offering ever. On the other hand, we know that Hevel brings the best that he has, mi b'chorot sono, right? B'chor is firstborn of his flocks, so that's a good thing. We don't know that necessarily that Cain brought something that's not the best, unless if pri ha'adama, if the fruits of the field are actually considered inferior to the fruits of trees. So we know that there's one plus on Cain's end and one plus on Hevel's end. They each have something going for them in their offering. But as we saw in verse 4, Hevel's offering is accepted and Cain's is not. Joel, do you want to keep going from verse 5 through verses 5 and 6?
But to Cain and his offerings he paid no heed. Cain was much distressed, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, why are you distressed, and why is your face fallen?
Okay. I'll point out here, and we'll get back to this later, that there's two expressions for Cain's disappointment. Right, there is, and the Hebrew, I think, does a better job again in the English. The first is Vayichar l'Cain me'od, and Cain was very, here it's translated distressed, but Vayichar in other contexts in the Bible means anger. So it might be that Cain was very angry, and vayi plufanav, and he falls on his face, or his face falls over. So there seems to be two emotional responses to this. And then God actually acknowledges that by saying, right, both why chara, why are you potentially angry, and why has your face fallen? I'll just add that there's a beautiful thing here in the Hebrew. When it says that towards Cain, he did not accept his offering, the Hebrew there's lo sha'ah, which means turn towards. So God didn't, there's this kind of like turning towards expression that you see throughout Tanakh. It's to face someone, means that you're, it's an expression of closeness and intimacy. So it seems that God accepts the intimacy of Hevel, but is not willing to kind of turn towards turn towards Cain in the same way. You see this kind of language in the priestly blessing in Birkat Kohanim. Yeah, Er Hashem Panavi Lechami. May God kind of bring his countenance upon you. And the word panim there is actually face. So you actually see this word of face here too, both in terms of the disappointment of Cain and also maybe in God turning towards one brother and not towards the other. Yeah.
God like the cute little lamb.
God like the cute little lamb. I hear. I won't sing Mary Had a Little Lamb because it's probably the wrong religious reference here. Okay. Thank you. No, that's good. So we're up to verses 7. I'll just say that verse 7 is a very hard verse to translate and leave it at that.
So, truly, if you do right, there's uplift. But if you do not, find sin couches at the door. Its urge is toward you, yet you can be its master. Cain said to his brother Abel, and when they were in the field, Cain sat upon his brother Abel and killed him.
I'll be asking those two questions later on, so we'll come back to those points. Todd, do you want to read 9 and 10?
The Lord said to Cain, where is your brother Abel? And he said, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? Then he said, what have you done? Hark, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground.
That's blood. Really, it should be your brother's bloods cry out to me. Yeah, it's the same verse that we had quoted before. At least that's the Talmud's interpretation of it. It's a good one. There's an extra yud there. Because if it were just your brother's blood, it could have said dam achicha in the Hebrew. And it says, instead the Hebrew in verse 10, which is yud, says demei achicha.
So akim yet.
So akim, the verb for cries out, is the plural. Plural present tense. So your brother's bloods cry out in the plural to me from the ground. Okay. And we saw from there before, right, the Talmudic interpretation is it's not just Hevel's blood, it's potentially future descendants that could have come from Hevel too, that cry out. All right. Sheldon, you want to do 11 and 12?
Therefore, you should be more cursed than the ground which opens its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. If you till the soil, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall become a ceaseless wanderer on earth.
Okay, harsh language. We'll talk a little bit about the punishments later. So 11 and 12 is what God curses Cain with. We'll see 13 and 14 is more about how Cain responds to the punishments. And if we had more time, we're not going to get into deep detail. You could actually compare the difference between what God says and what Cain hears. There is some contrasting there. But Kirsten, would you read 13 and 14?
Cain said to Hashem, my punishment is too great to bear. Since you have banished me this day from the soil, and I must avoid your presence and become a restless wanderer on earth, anyone who meets me may kill me.
Okay. At some point, there is room to ask, like, what leads him? Because God never says you are going to get killed, right? God says you're going to... The earth is going to rebel against you, as in your agriculture won't go well, and you'll be a wanderer. God never says you're going to die. So this seems to be Cain's reaction. That somehow Cain assumes he's going to be killed. Maybe some commentaries suggest Cain's actually asking to be killed. Maybe he's just saying, like, get rid of, like, if this is my destiny, I don't want to be around for this.
Maybe he just feels he'll be punished by other people.
Maybe he feels he'll be punished by other people. We'll see that that's one of the traditional interpretations of this. And finally, Robin, would you read verse 15 for us?
The Lord said to him, I promise, if anyone kills Cain, sevenfold vengeance shall be taken on him. And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who met him should kill him.
Okay. That verse is also difficult to translate. And I'll just point out that there is a different way to translate that verse. verse 15, that could it be read as whoever kills Cain, Shivataim Yakum, he will stand for, as in he, Cain, will stand for seven generations. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's actually a promise that, you know, Cain's going to be invincible for seven generations, and then he might die. Mm-hmm. There's a different way to read that, but we'll leave it for then. And then the rest of this chapter that I don't quote here ends up dealing with the genealogy of Cain, who his descendants are, and the birth of a third child of Adam and Chava, whose name is Shades. And it's just worth pointing out that at the end of this story, Noah is born as a descendant of Shades and not as a descendant of Cain. So if you kind of think in terms of how the lineage of humanity continues, just like Hevel has no descendants that make it past his murder, Cain has no descendants who make it past the flood, which is just worth pointing out. So there's kind of an end to that line. Okay. With that, let's go and try to address some of the specific questions. I think I addressed major questions already. I lined up some of the common ones, but just to repeat them. So when were Cain and Hevel born? I mentioned that as we were reading. What's the meaning of their names? We're going to get into that. What significance do their professions play in the narrative? What was the motive behind the murder of Hevel? And what was the nature of Cain's punishment, and did it match the crime? Those are the questions that I want us to think about. And now, with specific questions that we highlighted, we're going to do a little bit of flipping back and forward. And the key here is, in the translation and in the original Hebrew, I put the kind of footnotes of A through G. We're going to jump between them. Okay. So the first question that I wanted to ask is in verse 1. And this is A. This is footnote A. Which is that Chava says, right, that she names her firstborn Cain, and she says, what's the reason? Kaniti ish et Hashem, that I have acquired a man. And the conjugation here is difficult. It's et Hashem, which the easiest way to translate it here is that et, which is a very hard word to translate, Aleph Taf, I can never remember the grammatical rule here.
Definitely.
Definite article on a specific object. So I have made person with definite article being God. There seems to be, however you translate it, some kind of linking of Chava and God. That seems to be what's going on. What does it mean I have acquired something? And what does that have to do with Cain? So let's see Rashi's comment here. This is now flipping over to the next page. Rashi says that the way you should translate et Hashem, I have acquired a man, et Hashem, is kmo im Hashem. You should read it as with God, with an im, with an ayin. So I have acquired a person with God. And that's like a massive theological shift in the history of creation up to this point, right? Because until this point, who made people?
God.
Hashem made people. And now, who makes people?
People
make people, right? Huge transition. And that's what Rashi says. Kishabara utivet ishi, when God created me and my husband, hu levadobara anu, he created us alone, as in God was the sole creator. Aval bezeh shutafim anu imo. But now we are co-conspirators with God. And there's this idea that parents join with God and they're therefore three kind of partners in creation of a newborn person. So that's it on its own a big deal. One way, and then I'll get back to this later, that you can read into this though, is that Chava here is taking a profound step in the kind of very fine red line behind what is appropriate interaction with God versus what is inappropriate hubris relationship to God. Right? There's got to be a line between feeling close to God and comfortable like you would with a friend and feeling a sense of like austerity and honor and dignity and distance the way you would with a monarch or with a leader or with a respected figure. And what Chava here is doing, right, at least according to Rashi's interpretation, is she is taking a very clear step in the direction of me and God are like tight. We have a lot to do with each other. And this actually is a really difficult reading of a lot of the stories in the beginning of Bereishit, right? Who is Adam and Chava? Who are Adam and Chava? Are Adam and Chava employees, quote unquote, avadim? Are they servants of God? Or are they junior partners of God? And here Chava seems to be suggesting, at least this is Rashi's reading, is I'm no longer an employee. I'm no longer an Eved. I am now I'm on the management team, right? I am Im Hashem. I am with God. We're in this creating, acquiring things, building things, whatever kinyan means, together.
Co-equal?
You know, it's even a bigger stretch to say that Chava sees herself as a co-equal of God, but the way I often heard it described is a junior partner, right? Junior partner in the law firm, maybe, mm-hmm. right? Like, she doesn't have the veto, but she has certainly a say at the table. And that's a dangerous theological position for Chava to put herself in, right? To say that me and God have something to do here. One of the readings, and we're going to get to this now with the names, right? When you think that you are on equal footing to God, right, or equal footing with anything, when you think that you have ownership, right, kinyan from kayin, then there's a very close connection with ownership, which is kinyan can turn into kina. Acquisition, the feeling of entitlement that you own something, can quickly turn into jealousy. Kina, which is the same three letters, right, kuf yud nun. And there seems to be an interplay here that as you encroach on God's role as creator, right, you can overstep your bounds and think that you're deserving of things and get jealous of things that you don't have. And maybe that's going to play out in the life of Cain. So we'll talk more about that. On the other hand, Hevel, we already mentioned, and this is B, where does Hevel's name come from? Well, you see this in Ecclesiastes. I quote this here. A number of verses in the first chapter. It's really verses 12 through 14 in chapter 1, where Kohelet says, I am the king of Israel and Jerusalem. It's hard to read in the Hebrew. I place my heart to search out knowledge and to understand wisdom and to understand all the things underneath the heavens. And at the end of the day, hu inyan ra, natana lokim livne adam la nopo, these are all like bad, happy, unhappy business that God gave us. And then she... Kohelet, the king here, continues to go back throughout the book and say, what is everything? Hine hakol hevel ru'ut ruach. Everything is hevel, right? Maybe vanity, maybe meaninglessness, maybe breath, and badness of spirit. Again, maybe is that bad air? Is that air which is fleeting and therefore it's bad?
Well, hard to define. He realizes you can't take it with him.
You can't take breath with you, which is actually a great segue to the next source. Yeah. So that's the exact message in the next source. So while it's unclear what Hevel means in Kohelet, and there are different interpretations, it seems much more clear in Tehillim in Psalms chapter 144, where Psalms uses the word Hevel as Adam lehevel dama, man is like a breath, is compared to a breath, yamav kitzel over, his days are like a passing shadow. We say that, that's one of the opening verses we read before Yizkor, when we remember loved ones. Right, we just like breath, which is quick to pass, so too is the life of a person. There's something about Hevel's life that is transient. But there's something about Hevel's life, maybe, I'm not going to say it was preordained, but something about Hevel, by his very character, is he was never going to last, like a passing shadow. Why would Eve name him that? Look back at verses 1 and 2, because I think that's an important point. There's a difference in how Eve names Cain versus how Eve names Hevel. What, anyone want to think about a difference between the naming of both? I don't want to give too much away, because then it'll answer the question.
Well, she said something after Cain was born.
Yeah.
She announced who he was. Right. And then she bore his brother Abel, and Abel became a shepherd.
Yeah. Hevel
doesn't get short-lived.
Cain gets the speech at his bris.
Right.
Right. Hevel doesn't get much fanfare.
Right. I mean, Cain was fulfilling the prophecy of his name.
Okay.
Abel's name.
Kain, right, it seems that they have different destinies, which is Kain is, at least in potential, he's supposed to be the kind of permanent acquisition that is added to the world. Hevel, maybe this is good and maybe this is bad, but Hevel doesn't get a lot of attention. He's almost like the forgotten one laying in the background. right? Like a passing shadow, right? So there's something to that. There's something to that name and the fact that he doesn't get anything in the Torah while Cain does in terms of explaining who he is. The absence of Hevel getting a name, getting an explanation for his name is itself meaningful. Okay. Pri Adama we already spoke about. I will just mention one thing, and this is a theory that we'll develop further down the line, that Adam was commanded as he left the Garden of Eden to work a cursed earth. That seems to be the destiny that is given to Adam, to Adam. And Cain, again, who's the Kinyan, who's the permanent acquisition, who's the firstborn, right? Firstborns throughout the Bible take on the roles of their parents traditionally, unless if there's some kind of reversal of the order. But the assumption is that Cain's job is to take on the role of his father, right, as the firstborn. And so what's Cain focused on? It very, very much makes sense. Cain's job is to be the farmer of the same cursed earth that his father Adam was sent out of the garden to do. So that's Cain's job. Now Hevel comes along and, you know, someone's got a monopoly on agriculture already, right? Because now farming, working the earth, pri ha'adamah, the fruits of the earth, is his big brother's job. So Hevel either is forced into or chooses to be a disruptor, right? And Hevel creates, invents a new industry, which we call, not agriculture, we call shepherding, right? It's like the first Silicon Valley entrepreneur. There used to only be agriculture, and now Hevel is really the inventor, at least as far as we know, of shepherding. We're kind of taking a minimalistic reading here, that if it wasn't stated until now, we assume it wasn't in existence.
I just had this flash.
Yeah.
In the original creation story,
yeah,
we were vegetarians.
Ooh. Okay.
And here he is raising meat. Animals are going to be killed now.
Great. And
we weren't told to eat them yet.
No, so the second creation story, we were told that we can have, that we're in charge, and I believe it says, or it implies that we can eat
them. You were allowed to eat, I think it explicitly says you may eat of anything in the garden, but not, I think, not of the animals.
After Noah, then you can eat.
After Noah, it explicitly says you are now allowed to eat,
right
from the animals that have left the ark. So this is something our tradition takes for granted, that we were not allowed to eat animals until Noah exits the flood. Not coincidentally, the moment that Noah is allowed to eat animals, our tradition says there are the seven Noahide laws, and among them comes the first laws about the consumption of animals, which is you're not allowed to eat the limb of a living animal. There's something about the morality of eating animals. It's difficult. It needs to be regulated.
So there was nothing about that in the Genesis story about now you can eat meat?
I think it's only the fact that it's explicitly said in after Noah and the flood makes it imply that it was forbidden before. I don't remember there being.
What is he doing with these animals?
Yeah,
great question.
Clothing?
What is Hevel? Who gave Hevel the right to be a shepherd? If he's not allowed, first of all, who gave him the right? Because if you're not allowed to eat them, then you might assume that you're not allowed to do anything with them. Just let them roam free. And secondly, if you're not allowed to eat their flesh, then what are you going to do with them? And we'll see there's a line of commentaries that find that specific question extremely important. And I do plan on getting to them. Okay, that's fruits of the earth. I just want to skim over point D, which is that once Hevel's offering is accepted and Cain's offering is not, there's two reactions from Cain. The first is Vayichar, he gets angry, and the second is Vayiplu Panav, his face falls. And then it's Siv Rabbi Natali Tzvi Yehuda of Berlin, his takeaway here is that Cain had two reactions. The first is that Cain was disappointed that he lost his kind of firstborn status of being the best, and that that's about his ego. And according to the Nesiv, when you have a loss of face, I think that's still an expression, right? When you lose face, when your ego is brought down, that leads to anger. That's like the natural human response. On the other hand, there's another emotion that Cain goes through, which is that he didn't fulfill God's will. Because if God had want, if God was happy with Cain, even if he didn't accept the offering first, he would have accepted it at all. And so the second response he has is a sadness over a lost opportunity for the future. So he's experiencing two conflicting emotions. And there's a little bit of a kind of a tension here. What's going to get the best of Cain? Is it going to be Cain's anger that overcomes him? Or a kind of a nostalgia or sadness over lost opportunities? And what God tells him is, in the next verse, don't worry about your anger. Like, let go of your anger, let go of your sadness. There's still a chance to overcome. And that brings us to point E. Point E is in verse 7. And I'm just going to read it in English quickly. Surely if you do right, there is uplift. But if you do not do right, sin crouches at the door. Its urge is toward you, yet you can be its master. That's the translation. This translation is based on Rashi, who says you can be its master is you can be the master of your inclination. The negative impulse within you that makes you want to be angry, that makes you want to lash out for the fact that you're no longer the firstborn in status, right? The fact that you've lost opportunity that makes you sad. You can control your human emotions. You don't have to let your emotions control you. That's how Rashi reads it. You can read the source under E later. But I'll just point out there are commentaries that says Ve'atatim shol bo, you can rule over bo. Bo can, in Hebrew, the third person can either be on an object or on a person. There's no differentiation of it versus him or her. Well, there is a between him and her. So some commentators read this as, Cain, if you control yourself, if you lift yourself up again, not only can you control your impulses, you can actually come to control Hevel again. You can regain your status as firstborn if you control yourself and if you lift yourself up again. So what God might be beckoning to Cain is not only like get over yourself, get over your ego, right? You can be the master of your own desires. But it's actually, no, Cain, like the story's not over for you yet, right? The life is a very long rat race. And even if you are a step behind now, the story's not over. You can still kind of catch back up to first place and put yourself in the position of firstborn again. That, which is a really kind of fascinating nuance in the text. And I think part of commentary and parshanut is that when you have different opinions of how to read something, you can actually, there's truth in both of them, right? And the fact that this story is so complicated in its interpretation, right, each layer is unveiling a different layer. Each interpretation unveils a different layer of truth and of meaning in this narrative and in this story. I'll add one last thing. Which is the question of God says you're going to be cursed on the earth as a punishment and you will wander. And then Cain says, and now I'm going to be dead. So I'll just point out that Netziv and others say that what he's basically taking here is that he's telling to God, it's a powerful idea that Netziv says, all I had going for me, right, was the fact that I was an Isha Dama, a man of the field. I was able to do the work of my father Adam. It was hard, but I could do it. And now that you're bringing this additional level of curse upon me, that I'm not going to have any success whatsoever in the field, I have lost my worth in humanity. Right? I don't have anything to do anymore. And what he's basically saying is, if I bring no value, people are going to kill me because there's no reason for them to keep me around. It's like a really like dark place to go. But at least it explains. It's one interpretation of why does Adam introduce this idea of they're going to kill me when God doesn't say it in the first place. Okay. I want to introduce, and with this we'll finish, two kind of meta approaches to this story that tie in a lot of the questions we asked together. I wrote notes for them, so if you want, you can read them later. But I'll kind of just say them out. So the first is from Rabbi Yosef Albo in Sefer HaYikarim. This is a very old book. This is probably one of the first books of Jewish philosophy, I think going back to the 13th century, maybe the 12th century. Rabbi Yosef Albo is regarded as one of the early Jewish philosophers. In a similar, like, you know, in the pantheon of early Jewish philosophers, it's a bad word for Jews. in the hierarchy of early Jewish philosophers, like review, it's, you have the Rambam and oh my gosh, Rabbi Sadia Gaon, and like they're the kind of top two, but Rabbi Yosef Albo is pretty close up there as well. And he has a fascinating kind of read of this story. And the basic question is that there was a theological debate between Cain and Hevel about what is the role, it's actually not theological, more philosophical, what is the role of humanity in the pecking order of creation? Where do we stand with regards to the rest of creation? And Cain's position was that we are no better than the rest of the animals. And Hevel's position is we stand above the animals. So this is kind of how he frames the entire debate between Cain and Hevel, all the tension between them. And that's why Cain decides to become a farmer, and Hevel, on the other hand, decides to become a shepherd. That Hevel's actually disagreeing with his brother in his choice of occupation. Because at the end of the day, right, Hevel could have just been another farmer. There's plenty of earth to go around when there's only four people on it. But what Hevel is saying in becoming a shepherd is, no, God actually gives us control and mastery over other things. So maybe, to Kirsten's point, right, maybe we're not allowed to eat the animals. What are we allowed to do for the animals? So some of the commentaries say that milk, cheese, and butter were permitted from the animals. And these are viewed as like audacious luxuries when all you could eat until that point was like tree bark. These are considered very luxurious goods. Then Siv, this is not Rabbi Yosef Albo, says that this is actually some of the tension. And this is why actually Cain gets angry at his brother, because he thinks, I'm the one doing all the hard work and you're just the one enjoying life's luxuries. And so you have the ability to bring the best of your flock to God. But that's not fair. I'm the one who's like making sure that there's enough calories to go on, probably not with the potatoes, but with the bread that we're eating. Right? Like, it's kind of almost like a Marie Antoinette story of like, you know, Cain is saying like, we need the basics, and Hevel is going for the luxury goods, or the cake, or have their cake and live. Right, exactly. Save the Nitziv thing for now. But Rabbi Yosef Albo, right, the early Jewish philosopher, says that what is going on here is a debate between what do we have jurisdiction over as humankind? Just over plant life, over animal, or over animal life as well. And when God accepts Hevel's offering, right, Cain's response is, oh, I was wrong, right? If God didn't want us touching animals, then he wouldn't have accepted the best of the animals in an offering. So clearly my philosophy of our jurisdiction here, it was wrong. And at that point, though, God says, sorry, you know, you can make up for this. But Cain makes another mistake, which is, once Cain sees we have jurisdiction of animals, he almost makes the inverse mistake, which is, before he thought, we're no better than the animals, so therefore I can't have jurisdiction over them. But now he says, oh, if we're better than animals, then who are people if not animals? And so what does he do? Hevel killed an animal? I'll kill an animal. And who does Cain? And Cain kills his brother. And then God's wrath against Cain is basically, you messed up again in what the pecking order, right? Human beings are at a different plane than the rest of the animal kingdom. And just because you might be allowed to bring one as a sacrifice doesn't mean you can bring another. I thought that's a fascinating reading. And what it kind of does here, though, is Rabbi Yosef Albo's reading is that the professions that these two brothers take places shepherding higher up than agriculture, if you're thinking about it. And the tension between the brothers, the whole argument, is actually reflected in their jobs. Okay. I want to do a last piece, which is from Rabbi Amnon Bazak. Rabbi Bazak is a Rosh Yeshiva, head of the yeshiva at Har Tzion, at the Gush in Israel. Fascinating thinker and scholar of Tanakh, of the Bible. And he actually almost takes the opposite approach here, which is that Hevel, in name, in profession, in destiny, is the lower of the two. And that's kind of all wrapped in together. So here's what Rabbi Bazak says. It says, actually, if you're following the literary structure of this story, you start with a very clean order, which is first introduced to us as Cain. Cain is the firstborn. Cain is the kinyan, is the acquisition, right? It's the best of. And then Hevel. And who's Hevel? We don't really know, right? And then Cain becomes a farmer, and then Hevel becomes a shepherd, right? So far you have kind of an A-B-A-B structure. And then the order is reversed because Cain brings his offering, Hevel brings his offering, and Hevel's offering is accepted. So you see the A-B-A-B kind of turn into B-B. Does that make sense? And so that alone kind of gives you a sense that the one who started out lower is actually kind of ascending in rank just in terms of the structure of the verses. Just to point out other things, if you look at verses 2 and verses 4, Rav Bazak thinks that the kind of nature of Hevel is that he was essentially an afterthought. This was the pregnancy that, to put this in like not so nice terms, this is the pregnancy that Chava didn't know about or ask for. Where do you see that? It's the opening word in verse 2, which is, verse 1 is like beautiful language about Cain, and verse 2 is Vato Seif, and then she added something, right? Like, and then there was number 2, right? You also see it in verse 4, where you have this kind of and also language. Verse 4 is Hevel's offering. The Hevel Hevi Gam Humi Bchorotzono, and Hevel brought also he from the first of his flock, which seems extraneous. Unless Rav Bazak's reading here, and it's a careful one, is like Hevel's the guy who kind of sneaks in at the end. Hevel's the afterthought, both in terms of his origin, and even like when Cain comes up and brings his offering, Cain's the first. He does something really significant in bringing an offering to God. And Hevel, it's like, okay, my brother's doing it, I may as well bring something too. So it's a very different reading of like the Rabbi Yosef Alba, the one we spoke about before, is very much like Hevel is at the higher, he places man higher up than the rest of creation, that shepherding is a higher, loftier kind of act. And Rav Bazak is pointing out that Hevel is really the second in charge, very intentionally throughout the story. And you see in the names themselves, right, different philosophies about what is man's relationship with God. Cain, the firstborn, right, the one who's of significance, the one who brings the first offering, right, everything about Cain is kinyan, right, is acquisition, is a placehold in life, is junior partnership. That's kind of what Rashi was suggesting. That's Chava's intent when she creates him, im et Hashem, with God. Cain is about the idea of being junior partner, maybe being equal partner with God. And Cain is born with a sense of hubris, born into this idea that he's deserving of more, right? Being the firstborn. And Hevel, on the other hand, what does Hevel think about himself? I'm the fleeting shadow. I don't have so much going for me. You could even read the sacrifices that Cain brings. What does he bring? Whatever he has. He's basically just paying God in barter. And Sheldon, this kind of goes to an idea you were suggesting before. What's Cain's sacrifice? It's, you know, whatever was in the silo. On the other hand, Hevel's sacrifice is, Hevel's intentional, right? He takes the best of what he has. Cain feels deserving, feels like he's equal partner to God. So what does he give it to God? Just like whatever, doesn't matter. Hevel, on the other hand, who feels humble, right? Who's the fleeting breath, who's the afterthought. Hevel, because of his humility, brings the best of what he has. It's a much higher form of sacrifice. Right? Sacrifice is you bring something of yourself and you remind yourself that it actually belongs to God. Right? Cain does it in a very nonchalant way. Hevel does it with a deep sense of humility. And you can see it in their jobs themselves. This is the kind of inversion of Bazak's reading, is that being a farmer, being a person of the earth, is actually a job of permanence and stability. It's like, what is my job? My job is to care for this specific tract of land, and I'm going to do it today and tomorrow and in a year and in 5 years and in 10 years. This is my job, is very much rooted in a specific place. I'm stable, right? It's interesting that the Torah later on, like almost, this is his reading, and I think it's a fascinating one. The Torah finds danger in agriculture and therefore restricts it with an overwhelming number of laws. Because there's something about when you come into the land, right, that's the story of the Jewish people, you will become fat, you will kick back, and you will say, Kochi ve'otzem yadi, it's me and the strength of my hand who made all this. God, I don't need you. And so what does God say? God says, give tithes, right? Give something to the Kohanim who represent God, right? Take every seventh year off to remember that the land actually belongs to God and not to you, right? In the land, like everything you do, every step of the agricultural process in the Torah is another mitzvah reminding you, hey Joel, reminding you, I have to, like, I don't actually own the land. But Reb Bazak's reading is that that's fighting the impulse of a farmer, which is a farmer thinks that they own what they have. They own the land that they live on. On the other hand, shepherding by definition, we Jews, we like shepherds. We're big fans of shepherds. All of our favorite biblical characters are shepherds. And that's not coincidental. The shepherding, according to Reb Bazak, represents a sense of nomadism. Something like that. You know what I mean? Okay. It's transience, right? It's the very work of a shepherd is, by the way, navinad, which is one of the punishments given to Cain later. But the work of a shepherd is to wander, is to not have a sense of permanence in this world. It's to have a sense that everything is fleeting, and one day I might be here, and today, tomorrow I might be 5 kilometers away, right? Because I'm following wherever the sheep take me on some level. And finally, with Cain's kind of, he's born into feeling that he is the firstborn and that he's deserving and that he is almost on God's equal footing. And therefore, when God turns away from him and turns towards Hevel, the fleeting one, what is born in Cain? Kinah. Born in the one who thinks he owns everything is the feeling of jealousy. And he doesn't know how to control that jealousy because he thinks he's deserving of it all. And here we come to what's the consequence of Cain's actions? What are the punishments that are given to him? The one who thinks he's deserving of everything, who kills his brother, right, as a way to try to reacquire that which was taken from him. The response is, you think you're a farmer?
You don't have any land anymore.
No more land. And not only that, the land will take its vengeance against you. The language that God uses is, the blood of your brother is crying out. The earth is crying. Your brother's bloods are crying to me from the earth. It's almost like the earth is a character now in the story, taking vengeance against Cain. Cain's destiny is to be a wanderer, right? You thought you were permanent. You thought you were kone olamo. You thought you could acquire this world. And therefore you acted with jealousy, with kinah. And the answer is, now you're destined to wander, right? You have it's not just a punishment. It's a tikkun, it's a rectification, right? It's a fixing of his character flaw, that you will have to learn the lesson by being pushed into the opposite extreme of where you came from. I think it's powerful that really this is the second narrative of humanity in the Torah. And one of our most foundational kind of struggles as being humans, and I think that's why it's so early in the Torah, is the feeling that we are deserving of, right? And that what we have is ours in a true sense, that we have the experience of being like Cain's. That what I have is given to me and I earn, and it's mine and I earned it, and no one has the right of taking it away from me. And you could actually say that maybe this is the thrust of the entire Torah, right? Is to reorient us towards a Hevel-like attitude. What do we really earn in this world? We don't hold on to anything. Everything is like a passing black breath. Mm-hmm. Everything that we have should be treated with humility and appreciation and giving back to God from our finest and our best, right? As a sense of appreciation that we don't deserve any of it to start with. And maybe this is why that when it comes to the story of humanity, right, there is a Sheitz born later who's almost like a return to Hevel. Hevel is taken out of the picture because of Cain's jealousy, but Cain is not who we descend from. Right? We descend from a third brother, who's almost like a rebirth of humanity. And now, as the descendants of Sheit, it's our job to try to overcome that impulse of Cain within us and find something closer to a balance, closer to being willing to accept the fleeting nature of life's breaths and be grateful for everything we have and approach God with a sense of humility and thankfulness and the best of what we have, because it's not ours and it's just a gift that's on loan to us as long as we're here. So I think those are some of the lessons we can learn.
Is shit in the written Torah?
Yeah. Yeah. The remainder of this chapter is about the birth of shit.
Oh,
yeah. All right. Fantastic. Well, thank you all for being here. And next week we'll deal with more sibling rivalry.
Thank you so much.